don't love you back. Stay tuned every Wednesday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 Pacific, with your host, Boyd and Lucinda, for the hottest talk show in existence. The streets don't love you back.
I gotta do right before they call me home.
Good evening and welcome to the Streets Don't Love You Back show. Today is September 28th. I'm your host, Lucinda. Oh, we got something in the background going on.
I'm straight.
There we go. All right. Good evening and welcome to the Streets Don't Love You Back show. Today is September 28th, 2011. I'm your host, Lucinda, with my co-host, Boyd. And our topic is, as always, the streets don't love you back. Join us every Wednesday night with real people, real stories, and real changes as we hear the truth about gangs, drugs, violence, abuse, and other life issues. We have a great show for you tonight. We have Mr. Akil Bashir out of Los Angeles, California. He's internationally known and described as one of the nation's most premier public safety crisis intercession violence elimination professionals that we have in society today. So we're going to hear about some of his programs and what he does and how he helps with gang intervention as well as just in general public safety. Before we talk to him, let me introduce Boyd to the show.
Oh, hang on. Well, I show every Wednesday night, and I'd definitely like to thank our guests for coming on the show tonight and spreading his message as well. And without further ado, I'll pass the mic directly over and I'll have you formally introduce yourself to the fans.
Well, first of all, I salute both you for the work you're trying to do, the work you are doing, and the fact that you are giving back, and that's what this whole thing is about. I'm not one much for formal introductions. I let my work speak for what I do. I will say I'm a warrior in the streets, trying to make sure that that we can save some lives and we can restore these communities out here.
Hey, amen. That's like a winner right there. And first of all, I would just like to ask you to let the people know exactly what you do as far as giving back to communities out there in L.A. and across the country. What exactly did you do to bring that together as a unit out there?
Well, I have an organization, and I will give you a little bit of my history. I came out of the 60s movement. I was bred out of that movement. I was on the ground doing the work we do from that movement, and that what propels me to do what we do today. I was a former member of the Black Panther Party and just about every other revolutionary group that was existing at that time period. And our whole mindset, our whole mentality was to build our communities and to make sure we had a degree of self-sufficiency and self-reliance. And so when the gang culture actually started, you know, we were on the ground of that. Most of your young men who were in the movement and organizations, we came out of the street gangs of the cities that we were in. But to get specifically to your question, my organization, Maximum Force Enterprises, we are violence intervention specialists. And we're not only gang specialists, but we deal with all types of violence. Our motto, which is saving lives, restoring communities, providing hope, and implementing proactive solutions through self-reliance and self-determination. We base everything around that. We have over 21 different programs. We have a multidisciplinary, a collaborative of experts that we bring to the table. And we go into targeted communities. We go into besieged communities. And then we attempt to establish the needs in those given communities. Always at the top, and the reason why violence is at the top of what we do, you're not going to get any community to move itself forward. You're not going to get any community to take action. You're not going to get any community to rebuild or restructure itself if the prevalency of fear is foremost in that community. So the one thing you have to do is you have to knock down that fear. You have to give people the operational protocol to see themselves through that fear. They can't see their greatness. They can't determine where they want to go, the envisionment in life, if that fear is hanging over their shoulders. So we have a variety of programs that do just that. All my people are practitioners. That means we're on the street. We do the work. We not only train, we not only develop, and we're known for our training expertise, but we are on the ground. Most of my people have been doing this work for 10, 15, 20 years. Like I told you, I've been doing it since 69. So, you know, there's a comprehensive history, and because we have traveled the world over doing the work, we bring a much more larger scope to the table. We don't look at the localities. We bring in the common denominators that relate to violence from a worldwide perspective, and then we group them into systems, and we build the strategy or the action plan based on those common denominators. From that perspective, you're able to reach far beyond the boundaries of the generalized locality. So, and lastly on that, we're known for the PCITI, which is the Professional Community Intervention Training Institute. It is an 18-week hardcore community-based violence slash gang intervention professionalized institute where we train peacekeepers, where we train others in the social service field, ex-gang members, et cetera, how to go back and be actual professional interventionists in the community. And to date, we had over 400 peacekeepers on the street nationwide. We brought over 102 once-warring neighborhoods to the peace table, and we've created a what's called a Peacekeepers Collaborative Network, to where we reach out across the nation and bring people to the peace table to try to restore the negativity that's going on in their communities.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a winner, and I definitely commend you for what you and your organization does as well. You know, and it's a blessing to have individuals like yourself and others that's, you know, willing to give back freely. You know, and that's the most important thing. You know, each one gets one, reach one. And a lot of people out here in this lifetime, I feel, they forget where they come from, and they forget that, you know, when God bless you to come up out the Mary clay into the morning light, it's your job. You know what I'm saying?
So well said.
Understand? It's your job. You know what I mean? To go back and help our people come back forward and see the light within me, because it's not better in the world than saying, look what he brought me from, and he can actually do the same for you, you know? I also live under the old rules myself, you know what I mean? I treat my brother and sister as I treat myself, you know?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Make myself good, I'm going to treat my fellow man and my fellow woman good, but if I'm treating myself bad, they have nothing coming. So we have to bring that back into stature as well with our youth, you know?
Well, you know, very well said, soldier. Let me just be very honest, especially dealing with our youth. Those of us who are parents, those of us who are elders, we've got to embrace the concept that our job is temporary. Our job is to teach our youth how to replace us. It's not for us to hold on to it. You understand? You know, the work we do is a mandated responsibility. It's not a choice. And what we see in our youth is a direct reflection of what we put in. What's out is what went in. And so instead of always blaming them for the conditions therein, we've got to look at ourselves and say, did we leave the blueprint? Did we leave the roadmap for them to step into? And if you talk to most of these youth out here today, they will tell you, no, you didn't. You haven't protected us. You haven't taught us how to grasp our dream. You haven't given the road map so we can get our vision. But yet you want me to submit to your leadership and authority? We don't seem to grasp that. You know, the work we do and out here in these streets, it's not a game. You know, I always tell people, when you stand up, standing up for the work is not taking a seat. You stand up, and the higher you go, the more resistance you're going to meet. But you've got to be able to embrace that resistance and move forward. That's a, you know, that's what life is all about. So, yes, sir.
That's right.
Yes.
And you've gone all over the world teaching different SWAT teams from different companies, different countries, training them in actual crisis intervention. And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, what we do, Lucinda, we concentrate on violence. While we're premier gang experts, gangs are just one arm of the octopus. And if you're not dealing with the whole scope of violence, domestic violence, street violence, youth violence, aggressive hostility, et cetera, you're really just putting a Band-Aid on the process. We, when we developed the Professional Community Intervention Training Institute, our goal was to professionalize the street peacekeepers. What traditionally happened with intervention peacekeepers as it relates to gang intervention is most of them built their reputations based on relationships or LTOs licensed to operate in the given communities. So because very few people outside of those communities really understood the nature of the work, the young brothers and sisters that was out doing the intervention, they were able to ride on the fact that their relationships gave them carte blanche to do what they do in the community, and nobody was really questioning that because nobody really understood the type of work, especially coming from the ground level. So as more people started to embrace the work and realize the necessity for gang intervention or violence intervention, what we call community-based intervention, and the reason we call it community-based because we bring in the whole wraparound, when people started talking about trying to put some funding to that, et cetera, well, people wanted protocol. People wanted to know, what do you actually do? How do you operate in the streets? How do you have a template that's duplicatable, replicatable, et cetera? So we attempted, and fortunately, through the grace of God, we were able to create the professional protocols. We were able to create the what we call the SOPs, where the emergency responders, to where the people that understood the viciousness of the street could see what our organization was doing as an asset. Because of those templates, because we have blueprints, because we have what I call the skeletal structure. See, what people, you always hear an intervention to say is that, well, every community is different. Every community, you've got to bring different things to the table. That is very true, but I afford it by saying you have to have a generalized skeleton. You have to have the foundational base that interventionists operate from. Now, that's the framework. The skin is the flexibility that you need as you go into, let's say, a Latino community, an African-American community, or a community of different nationality. That doesn't mean your protocol in terms of your skill set changes. No, it does not. What changes is the flexibility of how you talk to people, the embracement of that culture, and you might have to take a different methodology to get through to that culture, but you don't change your base operational structure. I got to know that if you're in Chicago and we're in Los Angeles and this person's in Idaho, that we're operating the same when it comes to our standard operating procedures. But because you come from that community or you know that community, I'm going to leave it up to your individualized personality to best use the skill sets that you've been taught. But the skill sets are similar, and that's why we're able to go into any community and drop the protocol in place, because of the simple fact all our people are operating from the same set of standards. It does not differ internationally. Internationally, it's the same thing, because we study the foundational pieces or the protocol. We know the 5, 6, 7, 8 ills in any besieged community. And so our structure is based around those ills. I'll tell you, I've been to Africa, South America, Argentina, and let me tell you something. The common denominators are the same. The end product is different because of the culture, because of the different ways that the given community operates, but the same premise in terms of those common denominators are the same. But lastly on that, that's why it's so important that anybody who really does the type of work that we do, anybody that claims that they're doing community restoration, violence reduction in the community, you got to have your hands on the ground. You got to have your feet on the ground. You got to thoroughly ingratiate yourself into that culture. You can't, and this is unfortunate because we've got so many academicians who think that they have the expertise because they've went through 8 psychology classes, 4 sociology classes, but there's a serious disconnect because you don't know the people. You don't relate to the people when the people don't have any trust in what you bring to the table. The first thing in building a community and reducing the violence is to build a comprehensive degree of trust. The people got to believe in you first and foremost, and they've got to believe that you understand what they're going through and where they've been. You're not going to get nowhere if that is not developed first. And then from that, you have to ask the people specifically what they need. Your whole mission has to be cause-driven. If it's personality-driven, and if it's driven for self grandiose acknowledgement, you're going to fail every time. The cause is bigger than the person. So you've got to look at what that community needs and then build your structure and your action plan based on what they tell you from a bottom-up perspective, not you coming in with your expertise from a top-down perspective.
Right, definitely. I have some more questions on that, but I wanted to go back to the very beginning when you were young, growing up in Los Angeles. Tell us a little bit about what area you grew up in. We kind of know you grew up in the 60s, so we kind of know what you went through. But for those that don't know, you know, maybe you could just talk a little bit about what it was like, what you saw, and maybe what led you to join the Black Panthers and kind of the transition that you went through going through all of that.
Well, I grew up in the pre-civil rights movement. When I was in joined the Panther Party, I was 15 years of age, and I was born in the early 50s. So, you know, you still had Jim Crow on board. You still had certain discriminatory policies that were accepted in America. And even though I was a child then, certain things were obvious. Certain racist overtones, you don't miss them. I don't care what age you are. I was fortunate because my father was on board for most of our life, although later he divorced my mother, but he laid the foundation. And when he did divorce, he did not leave us. He was always there, even though my mother and him did divorce later on. But in the year and what pushed me into the whole process, my father was the first Black fireman that was hired by the County of Los Angeles. Actually, they hired him in 1956. And my father wasn't no chump. We grew up in Compton. We grew up in Watts. We grew up in Pacoima. We grew up in just about every so-called major hard city in the greater Los Angeles. We were there. We moved around a lot because my father was stationed in different venues. And some of the things he went through in the early years on the fire department, he used to come home and tell us. I have 2 brothers, and so he used to pass that message on. And I think partially part of the divorce was because of what my father did go through with the fire department. But my father could have very easily rolled over and accepted the degree of blatant racism, superiority, a complexity that was being brought to the table, but he did not. So he fought them. He fought them at every level, and he really blazed the path for other individuals coming into the fire service. My father filed a suit to the Supreme Court in 1972, and that suit actually put in place the city's LA City's affirmative action program. They were waiting to see the results. He actually won the case, but then a year later, they reversed it, and they reversed it predicated on, again, racism. So coming up under this environment and having those type of shoes to follow, it was almost a natural for me to go into the movement, because my father would always talk about resistance. He would always talk about fighting injustice. And one of the things that I did learn from both him and my mother, just like Brother Boyd said earlier, is you got to give back. You've got to consistently give back. And the whole concept, the whole mindset of the whole 60s was giving back. And that's exactly what my foundation was. I was primed to do. And what got me into the field of violence, you know, back in the movement, see, we were doing gang intervention long before gang intervention had a name. We were doing gang intervention didn't start in the 90s. Gang intervention, violence intervention started way back in the 60s, because we had to mediate between the different groups, who most of them were, as I so said, gang members. Most of the Black Panthers were Slawsons. We had the businessmen. We had the gladiators. But we were on a different type of war. We were on a political war. We clearly understood that we were, and our fight was, with the governmental structure. It wasn't with our people on the street. So it wasn't a self-destructive type of war we waged, although because of the different ideologies that some of the different organizations had, we did have serious wars within that structure. But most of our vent, most of our anger was with a governmental structure that we felt was unjust, that we felt was racially biased, and that we felt that didn't have any progressive endpoints for where we were going as a people. And keep in mind, this was before the civil rights kicked in, really the latter part of 64, and really didn't come into full bloom until probably the late 60s, around 69, 70. So that was the mechanisms of what we're in. When I was coming up, we knew most of the gang members today. We knew the founders of these different sets. We saw the whole era come into place, and that really kicked in around 80s, and that was because of a variety of things. Real quickly, you had the destruction of the whole economic pretext of the African-American community. Remember, in South Central L.A., most of your larger corporations, you had Goodyear, you had Firestone, they were seated in Los Angeles, and that's where most of the Black and Latino individuals got their jobs. So the incomes were really middle-class incomes, although it wasn't the type of professional middle-class jobs. The incomes were there. Well, that got decimated because most of those venues moved out around the early 80s. Then you had the major influx around 72 of the whole Superfly mentality. So you had the whole pimp, the whole drug pusher concept, the whole concept of four or five babies pushing drugs. That was a way to go. Then you had the massive influx of the drug market, and the only reason that took off like it did because you had the economic decimation of most of the major plants that was employing most of the individuals in the minority families. And then lastly, you know, the killer was the start of the prison industrial complex, and then the whole COINTEL movement under J. Edgar Hoover, which started taking the elder Black men and either imprisoned them, assassinated them, or they were on drugs. So a lot of these young brothers, the majority of these young brothers who would have probably went into the movement and got some type of personal refinement, et cetera, were basically out on their own with no money, with no jobs, with the drug scene at its height, and hence you had the start of the major warring conflict between the different sets in not just Los Angeles, although so much of it started here, really all over the nation.
Definitely. In Los Angeles, because we know that, you know, Freeway Rick Ross is from South Central, but the drug situation can you explain a little bit more about what you saw as far as when crack cocaine and all that came into the neighborhoods, how that kind of took over and kind of, you know, by storm, I guess, kind of took over a lot of people, destroyed a lot of communities?
Yeah, because we were in the middle of that. Remember, I was a peacekeeper at the time, and so was the majority of my crew. The 80s and the whole crack epidemic really came in like an army and destroyed, not just individuals, destroyed communities. It was almost like a tidal wave, and the thing about it was it happened overnight. And because most of your communities weren't prepared for it, they became very reactive in dealing with it, meaning that they reacted after the fact, and they were constantly trying to play catch-up to the destruction that the crack epidemic caused. Because the drug was so addictive, because there was so much money to be made, and because the young brothers being that they were in gangs, were basically fearless at the time. It was an unstoppable tidal wave. The law enforcement agencies didn't know how to deal with it, or in some cases really didn't. And I don't want to negatively cast it, but I think in some cases didn't really want to deal with it because it was isolated to certain neighborhoods. And, I mean, there was so much death and destruction. And I'm not talking about your average, you know, shooting somebody, et cetera. I mean, we're talking about families, generations being wiped out. We're talking about neighborhoods being wiped out because, you know, it was so much money to be made. And at the same time, once you got in that venue, you had to keep the reputation that you established in that venue. Hence, mix that in with the gang. In that era, a lot of the young men and young women became gang members because they were dealing with the crack infusion. And in order to be protected, they had to get in that venue. Now you combine the mindset of gang members, which is predicated on the 4R: respect, retaliation, revenge, and retribution, along with an unstoppable source of monetary power, which was a drug environment, and you created one of the most destructive monsters, a fearless monster that, you know, just was gobbling up these communities.
Right. I guess I can kind of describe that crack era as a tsunami. It kind of came in. Nobody was really ready for it. It destroyed, you know, not only Los Angeles, but, you know, robs from Detroit and lived through that there. I mean, many, many communities it destroyed, and we're still seeing the devastation too today. But you know, looking back, you know, obviously we didn't know then what was going on fully, I guess, you know, a lot of things we learned looking back. But knowing that the CIA had a lot to do with bringing the drugs into communities, you know, what's your take on that? How do you feel about that?
Well, there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, let me qualify, because when we throw something like that out there, we really have to be able to qualify it if people are going to give you any type of legitimacy whatsoever. One of the most important things that we were able to do back in the 60s, 70s, was utilize the paperwork that was acquired through the Freedom of Information Act. See, when the Freedom of Information Act was put or allowed, the government before that had the ability to basically, it did not have to expose any of transcripts, records as to how they operated, et cetera. But when that law, that order came down, we had civil rights attorneys, we had people on board hoping that the order would be in the affirmative, which it was. And they were able to get access to governmental files, to secretive files that most people thought we would never have access to. And in those files, it was specifically spelled out, the methodologies, the organizations, how certain things were going to be done. Now, they allowed them to black out the actual names of the organizations that were were being utilized to do what they wanted to do, but most of the information, at least 70 to 80% of it, was intact. And the Freedom of Information Act, even today, still opens up so many doors. But you know, people have become very secretive with their use of information because they know that the Freedom of Information will be utilized to get information. So it was just a different a time here. You got to remember, the federal government was really afraid of the movement, because the movement of the 60s not only sparked the revolutionary mindset of young black men, but you had Asians, you had white Europeans because of the Vietnam War that were saying that we're not taking this bull crap no more, because, I mean, the body bags that were coming home. You had the Red Berets, which were your Asians. You had the Young Lords, which were your Puerto Ricans out of New York. You had even your elders. You had Gray Panthers that were running around saying that we cannot take what the system is putting down. So, but the main venue that they were most afraid of were the African American. I don't even call myself African American. The black males, because of the fact that we had sparked so many other movements that were going on: Detroit, Los Angeles, New York, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they feared the Panthers more than anything, because we were the first group of armed men, armed militants, that said we are not going to take the type of oppression that's going on. And we were the first individuals that actually picked up the gun, because you got to remember, back in the era, the gun laws allowed us to carry guns. Matter of fact, most of the gun laws that you see today came from what we did back in the 60s, early 70s, et cetera. And so to say that the government had a hand, yes, they had a hand. And even today, I make sure, as we talk about the influx of violence, as we talk about the gangs, we always have to bring it back to a societal inclusion of responsibility, because they played a major role in where we are today. Now, I am not being accusatory of everybody that is in the system. One of the things I learned, and it was from the Panther Party, you had to deal with individuals on an individual front. While we had some of our most staunchest enemies who were Europeans, some of our best associates and partners were also Europeans. Some of our biggest funders that afforded us the ability to operate were white males, white women, et cetera. So I learned very early that you have to deal on an individual basis with individuals. If you see that they are pushing a certain a venue, I'll deal with it straight up. I don't care what color you are. I'm going to approach it from that perspective. But another thing I learned through the movement, just like we had white devils back in the day, we had just as many black devils. So I was able to really balance my thinking process out. And most of the people in the movement really, if they were being taught correctly, had that understanding. Okay.
Right. And then, of course, you say, you know, talk about the prison industrial complex. That all came about, too, at the same time that the drugs came out. And you know, we know that I think 80 to 90% of people in prison are there for drug-related charges, and a lot of them are not for selling drugs. It's for using drugs themselves personally.
Well, yes. Go
ahead.
No, you're right on point. And let me say this. When you go back to the governmental aspect of it, again, we got to remember, most of these communities did not have the developmental infrastructure to bring these drugs into these communities that these communities were unfortunately burdened against. You know, we've got to stop being afraid to call things like they actually are. We're really talking about trying to get to the core, to the essence of correcting the problem. We've got to be able to identify that problem clearly and make sure that we don't go back to what caused the problem in the first place. Drugs did not flood our community by the individuals who were, for the most part, using those drugs or distributing those drugs. They didn't have the mechanisms to do that, and especially back then, because back in the day, you really had geographic isolation in most of these communities, not like you have now where you have the freeway capability of coming in from Mexico or coming in from Brazil and certain things being brought in here. So you just didn't have that structure set up. The same thing with the firepower back in the day. The guns we were using, we did not have access to get to those guns on the open market. So they had to come in through a source that was able to bring those things in here and flood these communities with what we're up against.
Right. Well, you know, I'm going to say this, and I know, and we all know, whether people want to admit it or not, that we've had a lot of corruption in this country for many, many years.
Yes.
And, you know, back when they decided to declare the war on drugs, they're declaring a war on our own people. They, you know, it shouldn't have been called a war. A war is to fight, maybe you could even explain a little better for what you do with violence, but a war is a division. It's to me, war is violence. So they're declaring war on our own people, war on drugs, and that's where I think that the prison industrial complex came in, and they're putting everybody in prison, but they're putting the wrong people in prison a lot of times.
Yeah.
There's a lot of innocent people in prison. There's a lot of people in prison that are doing life term for their first drug offense that should not be there.
Well, and I think you explained it very well. Look, words are so important. Come on, let's look at this picture correctly. When you see America, unfortunately, almost every interaction they've had has been a blood interaction. This country is so pervasive with the use of violence. It is, how do you tell a young child you can't be violent when everything that that child sees from the military industrial complex, America having the military might individually of all the nations combined? When you see every action that this country takes to create some form of retribution or to correct the situation, violence is core within that. Violence is the common denominator in that. You look at the prison industrial complex. You look at the death penalty. You look at I can go on and on and on. And every time they have an engagement of disagreement on a worldwide basis, it is never a sit-down a mediation. It's always a military might that is utilized to either come to the end conclusion. So it's very hard to move young adults into the non-use of violence when they're totally surrounded on an ongoing basis with the use of violence. And that is a hypocrisy in America to say that we have a war on anything. And I'm not surprised they said a war on drugs, Lucinda, because they use a war to basically deal with all their issues of concern.
Right. That's true. And, you know, the truth is coming out. Truth always comes out in the end, you know. And you can get online now and you can see videos of elderly men and women in their 60s and 70s that worked for the CIA or FBI when they first got started years ago, and they are actually coming out with the truth, telling stories of things that they saw, things that happened, and you know what? The CIA and FBI were some of the biggest gangsters around.
Well, I think it is becoming so prevalent, but then we would have to switch gears, because when we know all this information, when we know the truth,
right.
We still have to go back to the communities and ask the communities, why have you allowed yourself to not be empowered? Why have you allowed somebody else to define the reality in which you operate from? See, there has to be some, and I won't call it self-blame, because, you know, all of us damn near in this and the Society of America needs some type of therapy. But we in our communities, we've got to start looking in ourselves to define the reality that we want to operate from. We've got to become self-determinant in moving the process forward. It's like if you know you've got this brick wall in front of you, okay, what are you going to do? Are you going to allow that brick wall to petrify you, or are you going to go around that brick wall, go over it, go through it, or go under it? I'm not saying to alleviate the guilt factor in that brick wall causing you to stop. No, and you continuously fight that battle, but I think so many of us have thrown up our hands and say, there's nothing we can do to alter what the system has done, et cetera. You know, we've got to have that empowerment. People don't move until they're totally dissatisfied with their present conditions. And we should be at a state of such dissatisfaction when we can't protect our kids, when we can't protect our elders, when we can't protect the communities in which we live. We should be up in arms. And there's seriously been a dumbing down of the ability for us to go out and be progressive in action. I mean, most of your progressive movements were fused by the young adults, were fused by college students, et cetera. And we have been so dumbed down through fear that we don't think we can step out and move forward and take action. And I'm not saying you have to go burn down the White House. Don't misread what I'm saying. What I'm saying is we have to question, we have to qualify, we have to hold the venues that are so-called in positions of leadership, we have to hold them accountable, and we have to dictate to them how we want our communities to look. We have to dictate to them what we want and what we need in our communities. And let me tell you, that takes sacrifice. When you're talking about stepping out in these communities and fusing a different path, like I said earlier, you're going to meet resistance. You're going to meet resistance from those that don't want that change. You're going to meet resistance from those that you're assisting to help change. But we got to be able to fend those blows. We got to be able to take those hits if we're really talking about becoming progressive to the point where we are self-determinant and we do define the self-reliance that we want to come from these communities. So I hold our people in the communities to a large degree. I don't say I hold them responsible. What I do is I always put forth the challenge. Okay, now that we know all this, what are you willing to do? What type of fight do you have in you? Are you willing to step out and put your back on the line to stand up for what needs to be done?
Amen.
And I think a lot of people are just so, you know, lazy fare. They just kind of like, well, I don't want to get involved. You know, I see nothing, I hear nothing, I tell nothing. And they just kind of go on with their little daily rituals and act like nothing's going on, so they don't have to do anything. But do you think people are, like, really afraid to get out and say something?
I think a variety of things. I think people are afraid, but I also think people, to a large degree, some people don't want to break their comfort zone. And then to another degree, see, you guys probably clearly understand. I'm sure you're probably my age or somewhere around there. Look, when we were coming up, there was a whole different mindset, a whole different thinking process. We understood that the things we did and the actions that we took were for a larger community. We understood that, okay, I might not personally benefit if we move in this direction, but the community will benefit. So in the process of a community benefiting, I'm going to get some benefit out of that, maybe not as much as I would like, but I'm going to get some benefit in this process. So, again, we were cause-driven. We were much larger. We knew that we had to make some sacrifices for the community to flourish. Well, the mentality today and the mindset today is of the individualism. It's of the individualist in terms of I need to get as much for myself as possible and forget what everybody else has or what they don't have, et cetera. And a lot of that has been fueled by the fast pace of the societal dictate. Now, I think also there's a lot of people my age who have done a lot, but they're living on past reputations. I tell a brother all the time when he comes up and tells me I did ABC, the first thing I ask him, well, what are you doing now? Okay? Mm-hmm. And if you ain't doing nothing now, what you did in the past is just that, in the past. And most of these youngsters, they don't know about what you did in the past. They have no recognition. All they see is what you do today. And I think a lot of people my age have got burnt out, have gotten scared, or just think that they don't have to do anything. So the legacy is not being passed. And then from a societal perspective, you know, the forces have done a real good job to instill that fear. I mean, you know, the whole 9/11 situation, the whole Patriot Act, I can go on and on and on. So you have a lot of people that are scared out there. Now, I want to make it clear here. We're not talking about going and tearing down the governmental agencies. We're not talking about creating some mass revolution. We are talking about using their own system of accountability, using their legal system to hold them accountable and make them do what they're supposed to do as a governmental fleeing. And then secondarily, we're talking about making sure that we define the needs of our community, that we are the ones telling them and directing them to what needs to happen in this community, providing the community infusement. But in order for us to do that, it takes unification. In order for us to do that, it takes collaboration. In order for us to do that, it takes the seeing of commonalities and common goals that drive what we do. So there's a lot of internalized work that we have to do, and the way we attempt to do it is by bringing systems to the table. Let's say a community is going through four or five things. We might bring in we have a program called Feed the Need, which is a free food program that we take two semi-trailers to some of the most besieged communities, and then we feed that community. But in the process of feeding the community, we set up a community mobilization because we have to have a response team on the ground, and then the community has to help load the truck, and then it's a processionary line that the community has to go through, showing them that in working together you can achieve certain things, et cetera. We have another program called Feed on the Street. We roll out with our team every Friday night to different neighborhoods, and I take out about 12 to 15 soldiers, and we hit the streets hardcore. And the young brothers, who we know most of them because of our intervention academy and the fact that, you know, we're considered OGs in the neighborhood, they see brothers on the ground. They see feet on the ground. They see men in the community. They see us talking. They know they got those that don't have fathers. There's some brothers out there that they could turn to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, and not to applaud, let me be real clear, not to applaud anything that we do. What I'm saying is it takes collaborations of that caliber, people coming together and bringing their expertise to the table to make things happen.
Amen. I agree with that all the way, my brother, you know. And just by listening to you, you know, I listen very well. And just by listening to you, you know, the same concept is the same concept I roll with, because God was among the people. He wasn't in no pulpit. He was on the on the block. And I tell people that all the time. If you're not out there in the mix, you can be in that pulpit all day, my brother. You feel me? You are not.
The wrong point.
You feel me? And one guy, one guy told me, he said, boy, he said, man, he said, you ain't never really been, you know, in the church houses too much. He said, but boy, you can show up on point when you speak that. I said, you really don't have to be in the church house. You probably just got to read and understand what you're reading, homie, you know?
Man, that's real talk. That's real talk. Look, if you look at all the prophets, each of them, Prophet Jesus, Prophet Moah, Abraham, Job, Muhammad, they were about putting in work, okay? And they weren't about sitting in from a pious perspective, talking about what you need to do behind walls. They were out in the street. They mixed with the people. They set the standard. When you look at life, part of life is to find out your divinity, your greatness. See, you survived millions of sperm cells to get here. God chose you to be here over a whole lot of entities, but he didn't choose you to come here and take up space. He chose you because there's certain work that you have to do, and I think part of life is trying to find out what that work is, what that greatness is. And in order to find out what that greatness is, you got to be pounding ground. You got to be out in the street. You got to be intermixing the people. You know, if you believe in the Bible, the Quran, the Torah, whatever book you believe in, you should be a walking example of that book. I shouldn't have to. You shouldn't have to tell me what your profession is or what degree of spirituality you hold. I should be able to see it in your actions. I should be able to see it in the work that you do. You shouldn't have to tell me nothing. I should be able to see that glow because you're putting it down and doing what you're supposed to do.
Right on, brother. That's, you know, like I say, I live by example, you know what I mean? And I live by what I put down, you know. And I like communicating with brothers like you, you know. When I don't really talk or say nothing, I'm really just vibing at what an individual is saying. And, you know, even though I've been doing a lot of wrong through my lifetime, you know, even though in the neighborhood I was always the guy who gave back, you know what I mean? And
yes, sir.
About me, you know, they say, man, you might do your thing, but they say, man, ain't nobody in the hood go hungry. You know what I mean? You always coming through saying here, but you know that's just coming from my upbringing in the neighborhood. You know what I'm saying?
That's right. And
everybody back in them days in the 70s and 80s, you know, it was all family, man, in the projects. You feel me?
That's right.
You up the street and I'm down the street. No, you know, we got Big Mama cooked chicken all day. We hustling all day in the park. You know what I mean? Everybody's music blasting, you know. But everybody was loving it.
Real talk.
Lost it, man. They lost that communication and that love for one another. And it's not being taught and it's not being shown, you know. And we need more people on the battlefield. And we need less preachers in the pulpit, you dig? And that's what I be letting these brothers know. You know what I mean? You can go to prison and come out talking to your preacher and get your big old church. That don't make you a warrior for the Creator. That makes you a warrior for yourself half of the time because you done told the plate to be passed 10 times and you ain't getting nobody to open up. And you feel me?
Yeah.
And you ain't got no lights on. And the only thing you done told the people is God will provide, and you done jumped in your bins and gone. So, you know, I have a conflict with a person like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the world is a false prophet all the time.
Boy, that's real talk. Look, like you said, you got the biggest church on the block, but the doors close at 4 o'clock, okay? You got people on the block which don't have a place to live, but you have them come up in your parking lot, you're going to arrest them. Okay, see, I agree with
right.
you. I got issues. The church, the religious institution, the mosque, whatever you got, they are supposed to be the hearts of these communities. They are supposed to breed out of these communities. And when they become closed institutions, it really is a testimony to what they are or not doing. And, you know, a real man of God understands that, or a woman of God, you know, they are an individual army within themselves, and they're fearless. You don't fear what the Creator has created if you really believe in the Creator as you say you do. So you're going to be able to go out there and do what needs to be done. But now also we're told by our prophets, we take our precautions. We don't go out there stupid. Don't misread me. But you have to be fearless enough to go out and infuse what needs to be done to get people to change their direction. And that infusement, and you said it so well, my brother, that infusement can't come from verbal dialogue. It has to come from physical action. They have to see.
Yeah.
Show me what you want me to do, and then show me how to do what you want me to do. Don't tell me to do it. Give me
right.
the directions and give me the blueprints.
Right.
I mean, the only thing you done did in the pulpit was screamed and everybody done shouted a little bit, you know what I mean? And you know, Big Mama on the front seat, you know what I mean, done took his hat off and shouting for a few minutes, and everybody done passed the basket around. But really, at the end of that day, when the service let out, like you said, 4:30, 4 o'clock, okay, who life we done saved? You know what I mean?
Who life we done saved?
Creator.
Yeah.
Who life we brought to the Creator? Because at the end of the day, after all the sermon is gone and the hooping and the hollering and the shouting and throwing hands, you know, it's all about she looking at your work. She ain't looking at
right.
Let's go up in. She ain't looking
right.
at their work.
And then again, not to put down all religions, because there are a lot of groups that do help in their communities,
right.
and it may be with their own little community, but at least they're doing something, you know, and that's what we want people to realize. You might not be able to go out and change the world, but you can start in your own little corner of the world, in your own little community. And once you can help make a difference there, then you can spread it out to another place.
Well, I definitely don't think we need to put religion down. What I think we do is need to put religion in its place. Okay,
right,
amen.
I'm a man of God. I believe in the much higher source. And that's one of the things that keeps my behind humble. But at the same
right.
token, you know, a holy man is one that is whole. And most of these preachers ain't whole, so they can't
right.
be holy.
Exactly.
You understand where I'm going? So we've got to bring the essence of what real spirituality is back into the religious institutions, because, you know, the religious institutions at one time in the history of this country were the only saving grace that we had that gave us that resilience and that motivation to keep moving. They have become a commercialized business today.
They're businesses.
They don't
They're making money. Exactly.
Yeah, they don't do no soul healing. And I like what you said, Lucinda. Let's don't condemn all the religions. You got some people out there doing some good work. And I would just qualify by saying, if the shoe fits, wear. Okay? And if you know
exactly.
you're doing the work, keep on doing what you're doing. We need everybody at the table. We need our religious
right.
institutions. We need our soldiers on the street. We need our people just like you guys on the radio getting the communication message out. We need all that. But we need the right people for the right reason if we're going to change this. The intent has to be correct, because the intent dictates everything. If you do a good act and it turns out good, but your intent was bad, well, the act is bad. Same thing
right.
if you do a bad act, but the intent was good, well, the act is really a good act. It's all that internalized intent. And we have to hold the people in the church. We have to hold all the people out there that say they represent us in the form of leadership. Okay, leadership comes with a cost. Leadership brings
mm-hmm.
responsibility with it. Leadership means that you've got to hold yourself to a higher standard, and you've got to set a standard in place that most people are going to live by. That ain't easy to do. And most people who claim to be leaders, if they really knew what the responsibility that goes along with leadership is, they would run from leadership. You know.
Amen.
Right.
Amen.
And maybe that's what they're all doing. They're running. They don't want to take care. We got too many people running away from leadership and responsibility. We need to bring them back home.
Yeah.
We need to teach them how to be responsible, I guess.
Well, if you have a true leader at the table and you ask the people will say, we led ourselves, because true leaders never want to be out on Front Street. True leaders are not looking for the glimmering glory of life. True leaders understand that it is a role, and in the process of leading, see, we've all been given the expertise and knowledge we have for a reason. I always say consequence is God's way of staying anonymous. You understand? So... So what you got, it's not a consequence that you got it. You were given certain skills and expertise, et cetera, because you were chose for whatever reason to be that vessel to get that message out with that expertise. And you were chose because you were the best one for that mission. But the thing is, whatever expertise you got to give it back. What's that old saying? If you don't use it, lose it. No, it's more like
right.
if you don't use it, it's going to be taken away from your behind, okay? Because it's not yours to keep. And I think if we embrace that, you know, which is we've allowed so much selfishness to cancerously infuse in our communities. We think what we got belongs to us. You know, I always tell people this life is temporary. I don't know nobody that has gotten out of this life alive. And if you do, let me know because I would like to talk to them, okay? So at the end of the day, we've got a limited time to do a certain amount of work. And I think our job is to find out what that work is and then be the best at doing that work that we possibly can. See,
right.
Man. We're not here. We're not here in this life to take up space. That's the point I'm trying to make. We all have a specific role that we play. We just didn't show up one day and say we're here.
Right, you know. And, you know, I just want to iterate on that. You know, I say all the time, you know, that, you know, I never wanted to leave this earth without being able to have something to show for my existence and what I did to give back to others, you know. So that was one thing that my mother put in my head at a very young age, as a young boy.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So that have always stuck with me all through my life. And I thank God that I have did things. If he came for me right now, I have done good things, you know, for him that his work will be showed, you know what I mean, forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's about to bring people to the kingdom, and that's really the bottom line with me, you know what I mean? Material things and all of that, that means nothing to me, you know what I mean? I heard all that as a young man, you know what I mean? And that means nothing to me now. You know, I'm just a normal guy that likes helping people if I can and like giving back, and I love life, and I love my grandkids, my wife. And that's me. I'm just ignoring
That's real talk.
Yeah.
Lucinda, you were getting. I'm sorry. Go ahead, brother boy.
I was just saying, man, I did so much at a young age. You know what I mean? At my age now, all that don't even matter to me. You know what I'm saying? At all.
Yeah. I totally agree with you, brother. Yeah, I mean, well said. Lucinda, you were getting ready to say something. I think I interrupted you. I do apologize.
I was just, it just made me think about the story in the Bible about the talents. Those were given many talents, and the ones that used them got more, and the ones that went and buried theirs ended up losing them. So we're given talents and we're given graces, and we need to go out and share them with others and use them and, you know, and help change our communities.
Well, I agree, and I think that's what Brother Boyd was alluding to, and I'm not speaking for the brother. He speaks well for himself. But what I got from what you initially were saying is we got to stop hiding behind religion. We got to really get out there. And I don't even like to say religion. I like to say the essence of spirituality, because there's a big difference between religion and spirituality. And if people understood that, somebody's telling me that they overhear and they worship in this box in the middle of the street, but I see their actions changing. I see them doing constructive work. I see them just taking off to a whole new height. You know what? I'm going to respect that box. I might not believe in that box myself, but I'm going to respect that box because there's something that they saw within that box that caused them to move forward and be better than what they are. So, you know, I'm going to respect that, and I think if we embrace that concept more, I look at people who are doing work and doing work constructively, and then I try to look at having the respect for whatever they say they're about or believe in, because something is causing the constructive progression of that individual. So that's just, I think, we just got to be more inherent of others and what they do and what they see, and quit letting our own personalized venue dictate, cloud, and discolor the ability to move forward.
Amen for that, brother. You know, and I want to iterate on that too. You know, it's like with the religion we talk about. You know, that's the greatest thing about America. You know, we can be whoever we want to be. You know what I'm saying? And but at the end of the day, the only thing we all saying on this radio show tonight, and I know we all going to agree, is that the people that's in these poor pits that has never been out in these streets, only thing we're saying, you need to go out and seek a little bit more than behind the pulpit. That's basically all what we're saying. We ain't against you because you got the big church and you got the pulpit. We saying get out and get to know God's people because that's
where
it started from.
Definitely.
That's right.
You walk along the process to the pimps, the hustlers, the whores, the murderers. So we just asking you to do the same thing he did. If you say you're called by the Creator, you need to be doing that. This ain't something we're saying.
Right.
This is something that's required by him.
That's right.
Hands down. You know what I'm saying?
No, that's real talk. That's real talk.
Come out the pulpit, park the Mercedes for a little while, man. And get on the feet tip. You feel me? Get on the battlefield. You know, because he didn't ride no car either, or no horse.
Well, if you look at the life of most of the prophets, peace be upon them all, you'll see that those lives were not easy lives. So people try to paint these pictures of these pious individuals. Most prophets went through pure hell trying
Amen.
To do the work and stand up. I mean, they had more challenges than most of us 10 times over. So if you really are going to take the example of God's workers, look correctly. Don't infuse this false picture so you could have a nice life thinking that you can sit in a church or a religious institution and God's going to come down and do the work for you. He says you got to take the first step if you want me to. I'll take 10, but you got to take the first one. So we just got to quit playing with religion. And using religion as a scapegoat for us not doing any work that needs to be done in the streets, not doing the work that we need to do to save our children and save our damn communities. This is nothing to be playing with. In the war, the hell that's going on in our communities, you can't come to that war with no cap gun. You got to have something that is going to do some instrumental damage in stopping this crazy viciousness that we're up against.
Amen.
Absolutely. I wanted to go back to that too. As far as the gang intervention part, you know, do you see through your experience and what you do that the violence is better, worse, or the same? Or I mean, I know that we have more, you know, higher powered guns and different terror techniques and different things. But as far as I'm talking about, like, kids with and even adults, I guess, with as far as gang violence, how are you seeing that with what you do?
Boy, if I was to get, I'm going to get into it, but that's a whole nother show. But no, but look, just to deal with what you said, see, let me say this, and I really need to be real clear here. There are some soldiers and sisters on the street that have been doing this work for years, and they've done it from their heart. They've done it for the right reasons. They didn't do it because they were driven by a paycheck. They didn't do it because of the accolade of fame. They did it because they realized if they didn't do it, what the consequence would be. In the last 5, 6, 7 years, we've had a whole lot of hypocritical pimps and prostitutes get into the circle of this work. We've had a lot of people get into the work because it has become it's become politically correct, and people have recognized the work, and so it's being done for the wrong reason. Now, you still have the infusement of real people that are doing the work for the right reason. But when you get an influx of individuals that are doing it for the wrong reason, you pollute and poison the whole work. It's like you debase the standard. You debase what people see. It's almost like you sell your soul for that dollar bill. So to some degree, to a very large degree, the work of real interventionists has really taken many communities to a new height. But by the same token, you've had the influx of individuals that have really chopped it down to a degree. We step up the ladder 2 steps, and then we get knocked down 1 step because we've got people in it for the wrong reason. Now, the people that are doing the work for the right reason, and don't misread me, both of you. I'm not saying that you got to be poor, broken, and homeless to do this work. No. Definitely you need to get paid for the work. Definitely you should be taken care of for being in the streets at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning saving the lives. But what I'm saying is that paycheck cannot be the driver that constitutes you doing the work, because when that paycheck stops, guess what? The work is going to stop if that's what's driving you to do the work. So
right.
I don't want to be misread on that. Those of us, and me being one, who are out here, we definitely need to be taken care of. We definitely need to be appreciated. But that can't supersede why we're out here now. The ones that
right.
are doing the work, and let me say this, the reason I don't emphasize gang intervention, although we're at the top of that, is because if you're only doing gang intervention, you're doing a real disservice to the community. You have to do holistic wraparound service providing if you're going to benefit that community. Gang intervention and violence intervention, as I mentioned earlier, at the top, because it reduces that fear. But once you reduce that fear, once you get that fear buffered, once you get that fear taken care of, guess what? You have to have somewhere to take that community. So that means you have to have programs. That means you have to have social services. That, hold on 1 second, you guys. Yeah. So you have to have these other venues that are in place, and you have to have that massive collaboration, because you can't do it all. So I think one of the most important things that came into the work was the professionalizing of the work with the different institutions, et cetera, that are out there. One of the other crippling things about the work is once the work started to get to some degree politically acceptable and acceptable by venues and issues that that didn't accept the work before, well, guess what followed that? What followed that was your academicians and your researchers. Now they want to take hold of the work. They want to define the work. They want to lead the work, and they don't know a damn thing about the work. And they've been one of the most detrimental group of people that have came into the work, because they came into the work because of the monetary return that they felt they could have got out of the work. Now, let me say this. I work with some outstanding academicians and researchers, but those that I work with, they're all practitioner-based. They're on the ground. So they're bringing their expertise, and they're getting it done because they mix in the community. But that's not the case with most academicians. That's not the case with most researchers. They want to operate from their ivory tower. They want to read off page 79 and give you the direction that you need to take. And then they want to do it from a distance. And more importantly, they want to take charge of the work. And unfortunately, a lot of those interventionists that I was talking about, a lot of those monetary driven individuals, they side with these type of people because they think these people are going to take them to a new payday, the promised land. And so you got people that are in bed together that shouldn't be in bed together, poisoning the work that's being done, you know.
Right.
But
right.
to answer
Definitely.
Your question, overall, there has been great work that has been done, and you still got a conglomeration of people out there because of the recognition that's coming into the field. There has been great work, and I will say this, that suppression, prevention, et cetera, without intervention being seriously in the mix, there is no way possible to save or salvage these communities, no way possible whatsoever. And I'm speaking from 40 years of experience on that.
Right, and I've heard a lot of interventionists say, you know, in order to bring the young youth out of the gangs and stuff, you have to have something to replace that with. Show them, you know, how they can get a job, how, you know, educate them on what they can do to change their environment.
Well, that's called command presence. You're right on point. Look, you have to, in order to get somebody, we call it dysfunctional mindset change. In order for me to change what you're doing and where you're going, I've got to be able to replace what's driving you with something of equal value, and in our case, something that's socially acceptable. I've got to make you think you made the choice, and I've got to be able to fall back and make sure you guide it correctly while I'm not even in the picture.
that's a large order you're asking. You've got to change.
That is.
Mm-hmm. You got to change the mindset. You got to be able to provide something of equal or greater value, and then you've got to make the individual think they were the ones that made the change while you knew you were the anchor to orchestrate that. And lastly, you've got to stay silent in the process while you orchestrate the change.
That's a tough job.
It's a tough job. And that's why this work ain't easy. And those people that run up in here and think they're going to come in with a quick Band-Aid, I mean, you know, we've got some serious damage that have been done in these communities to our youth, et cetera. And, you know, it's not no coming in here and pounding on the ground for a week, a month, 6 months. Sometimes you can make some serious turnaround in a 3 month, 6 month process, but that's rare. Most of the time, it's years in the making. Most of the time, you're going to be somebody. You're going to have to mentor them. You're going to have to be there when they're in need. You're going to have to be there when they come and tell you, man, I ain't ate in a week, and could you drop some food on the table? Or my light's getting ready to cut off. You got to be able to come in there with some type of resources. You've got to show these individuals that you're there for them, you got something for them, and you can take them somewhere with your expertise. And that's a tall order. That takes a lot from the individual that's out there trying to do that, and that's why your commitment has to be so great. Your tenacity has to be so great because you realize you're going to be drained in the process. But the end result is when you see that life saved, when you see that community salvaged, guess what? That should recharge your battery for the next time out.
My man,
right.
That's what it is, you know?
That's
exactly what it is.
Yes.
So, you know, would you give the people your website and everything? Someone would like to contact you?
Love to. Our website is, and this is one long word, and I'll spell it for you, is MaximumForceEnterprises.com. That is MaximumForceEnterprises.com. They can also catch us on Google. My name is spelled, well, you guys have it on the website, A-Q-U-I-L, Bashier, B-A-S-H-E-E-R. And they can also look up on Google the Professional Community Intervention Training Institute. Again, the Professional Community Intervention Training Institute. And then our office number is 323-295-1904,
323-295-1904. And would you give some advice to these youths and these adults as well out here? What advice would you leave them to make?
Well, real quickly, and I'm glad you asked that, boy, we always want to leave with some solutions and some answers. First
Amen.
And foremost, as it relates to violence, you've got to get ahead of the violence. You've got to become proactive in your thinking. You can't be reactive. When you're reactive, you allow stimuli to control your situation, so you're operating at a 50% deficit because you're always trying to play catch up. You've got to read what's going on. Secondly, you got to place yourself in what we call scenario training. You got to look at the five worst things that could happen to you in a community and then plan for them. You got to reconstruct them. If these five things can happen, okay, let me put my children in this and see exactly what we're going to do. You got to we say you got to talk through, you got to walk through, and then you got to run through. So you got to put yourself in the actual situations. Then you've got to come back as it relates to, and gangs might be one of them, et cetera, you've got to make sure you got an action plan. You've got to make sure you got a structure in place. If this happens, you've got to make sure you're going to do A, B, C, D, and you've got to train. Lastly, you need to create a network of individuals. You need to create a network of people that can reinforce what you're trying to do. Every time I leave the house, I've got certain people that know my ETA or where I'm going, my estimated time of arrival, my estimated time of return. They know if I'm not or if a call's not made an hour past 8 or an hour past 9, something's going on. You've got to create a communication network of resources that can assist you when something goes on. If you don't have the expertise, you've got people that you can call that can give you the expertise to do what you need. And lastly, the most important thing is everything you do, especially as it relates to violence, especially as it relates to community reconstruction, you have to have templates that you're operating from, and those templates have to be flexible enough to where once you go through a situation, you debrief it, see if you handled it right. If you didn't handle it right, get your butt back to the table, redraw that plan that you had, and make it better.
My man. That's a good look. You know, I passed mic over to my missus to see if she had any for our last announcements, and then I'll follow up with that.
Well, I just want to again say much respect to you both. I appreciate what you guys are doing. You're doing some outstanding work. Any way that we can support you on this end, you know we're there. And keep doing what you're doing, because more people know and are benefiting from you, from what you're doing, than you realize.
Hey, I appreciate
thank you, man.
We'd like to give you a big, you and your whole team out there in L.A., you know, for all that y'all are doing as well. And the same thing applies, you know, we're in but an email away, you know. And
Vice versa. And you're telling me your people, if they need assistance, they can hit me up on the email, too, and I can provide something. Viva back in email, et cetera. But I believe in creating partnerships, and I'm glad we got one here. And you guys know that I believe in that collaborative process. So we there for you for what you need, and we got your back.
Hey, we got
Thank you so much.
And got everybody on the team that we're just happy that everybody is still on the battlefield, and you know, once again, not knocking the churches, but we glad that the people is on the battlefield and not up on the pulpit. You know,
I agree, and I want to clarify that too. I'm not knocking the churches at all. We realize the role they play. We just got to get the right churches and the right people doing the right thing for God's reason, not their own reason. Yes, sir.
Right, we're on the battlefield. All we saying, we don't knock because you come to church and open your doors. Yeah, we got much love for that.
Right. You know, and just going back, you know, actions speak louder than words, no matter what you do, whether, you know,
well
it's religion or anything in life. You know, there's always people watching, you know, so don't think that you're always in secret, because there's always somebody watching something.
You're definitely not the wrong ranger.
I always say you know, we go around, we got a camera on our shoulders everywhere we go.
That's right. That's right.
Yes.
You know, and it's what you do in secret that counts the most, because we know God's watching.
Well said.
You know, your intentions and what you plan on doing out here. But, you know, we appreciate you coming on. There's so many things we could talk about. You know, we'll have to have you on the show again another time. So I definitely want to talk about actually what you do out in your intervention programs. And, you know, I know that's a whole nother show. Or we could talk for hours. But we'll definitely have to bring you on again sometime and talk about, you know, more about what you do with your programs and how you actually get out and teach and what you do with all of that.
Got it. Love to come back. And you're right, that's another whole show. And next time I do come on, we'll really get in depth with that and give some real skill sets to the listeners in terms of what they could do, okay?
Definitely. And we're looking forward to working with you. And, you know, I'll get with you on email, but I want to maybe get some more information from you as far as tools on educating during presentations and stuff like that.
Got it.
We go out and talk to a lot of schools and just tell our story, and you know, we want to kind of bring some more intervention tools into that as far as educating and giving them some different avenues of you know, changing their life and stuff.
We love to work. We love to work with you there. We work with a lot of the schools, our youth programs. We'll talk about all that next time, but we'd love to do that with you guys, okay?
Yeah. Great. Sounds awesome.
All right. You guys keep your head up. And really appreciate coming on the show and really appreciate you guys having me. Much respect.
Thank you so much for you coming.
Thank you very, very much. Right. We appreciate all of your knowledge. It's taught us a lot.
And
we hope it's not taught somebody else out there.
We taught each other. We taught each other. All right.
All right.
You guys have a good one now.
Thank you so much.
Bye bye. Stay up.
Bye bye. And we'd like you to join us next week with our guest, Terrence Stone. He is the president of Young Visionaries, the Youth Leadership Academy out in San Bernardino, California. And he works with a lot of youth, educating them and has programs for them to actually get off the street and do positive things in their communities. And so join us next Wednesday night with him. And we'd also like to remind you that we have our books for sale on our website, the Never Hit a Woman and the Streets Don't Love You Back books, as well as our T-shirts, caps, coming soon, many, many other things to the store. We do have educational materials and brochures as well. So please visit our store page on our website, and that's at thestreetsdontloveyouback.ning.com. And, you know, we just like to thank everybody for your support, and please join our website as a member. And, you know, it's a social network where you can put your profile, your picture, your information, share blogs and stories and videos and things like that. So as we network, we just like to have you get on there and share with us what you have and what you know. And, you know, let's try to change our own little communities. And then eventually, you know, maybe that will change bigger communities in bigger parts of the world. Once again, we'd like to just, you know, thank Akil Bashir for coming on tonight and sharing his knowledge. He's definitely an expert in his field, and we're, you know, appreciated that he was able to share some time with us tonight. Boyd, what do you have the last word?
I just want to say I thank everybody for tuning in tonight and just keep, you know, rolling with us and helping save lives and helping these youths out here. So we just want to give big love to everybody, and also want to give big love out to Grand Slam Records, my sister label, and BNY Records and the Cole Gambino label, and JFK and her whole squad, and Christopher Williams. So we just like to send out much love to them, much love to our whole team on lockdown and in the streets, and much love to my man, Mr. George Montalbano. We definitely pushing that envelope for you, and the newsletter is out, the August, September newsletter is out, and it will be sent out to people all over, you know. And right now, well, we got 50 prisons up under our belt who roll with us and educate these kids, you know. So much love to everybody. And if I forget anybody's name, I just mention everybody that comes to. Peace and love.
Definitely. And if you know, like to get a newsletter from us, just give us an email or message on our website and let us know. Give us your address and we'll send that out to you. And you can also check it out on our movement page. We have it posted there as well. We're going to go out tonight with the song Guide and Protect Us by Rising Sun. And we would, you know, ask you to all have a wonderful, safe week and join us back here next Wednesday night. Remember, the streets don't love you back.
Definitely.
Good night. Well, that one doesn't want to play for some reason. We will play Streets Don't Let It Back remix. There we go.
What's up, what's up? This RB checking in with the Streets Don't Love You Back. The movement is on, baby. Letting you know, me and LD talking about that thug/drug life. Let me tell you a little lesson, players. In these streets, baby, They'll never love you back. Trust that. Everybody's around here talking about all that thug life, player. Talking about that drug dealing thing. Tell you, baby, it's about getting your life together, getting your head on tight, doing something with your life, and stop destroying your community and stop destroying yourself, baby. But when the people come at you, they come for real, player. Homeboys on my team done got 400 million before, baby. 100 million, baby. Now they sitting on death row, baby. That's where you want to be, player. Cause the drug game is washed up. The thug game is washed up, baby. They put it in our communities, baby, and they tell us off the top, yeah, you can make this, you can make that. But once they come for you, game over, lights out. Do what you feel, do what you want to do, baby. So join the movement. It's the streets, baby. They don't love you back. It's the streets, baby. They don't love you back. Come on, come on.
In the street, no one's above you. In the street, no one can touch you. In the street, love
yeah,
if
yeah.
you want.
This track here is a track of knowledge, you feel me? Want all young brothers and sisters across America to understand that the drug game, the thug life, that's all washed up right now. Take heed, learn from players that can live that life, you feel me? Much love to my man, the real freeway Ricky Ross. Jeff Step Down, May 4th, we sending you much love out there to Cali, you feel me? Much love to everybody across state to state who roll with the movement. It's time to open your eyes up, people. It's time to rise up above all this street thing, you feel me? It's a better way. Let's do this.
It's moments like this when my back's against the fence that I say, fuck the fence. Life is just, I gotta go and get a bit. God, he caught up the moon. Shit, I'm strong. It started from my home, so I'm at home when pressure's on. We all alone when we born. We all alone when we die. We need to get our shit together. We can make it if we try. So probably fake it if you cry. But I hate it when you whine. And if all the truth is up, then you can take it when you die. I'm on my grind, cause all I got is time. But maybe it's enough. But if it's not, then let me know. Cause I feel like I'm on bus. I'm overstuffed with propaganda. This is slander. Lies, try to slick the public and then wonder why there's crimes and murders on the rise, cause we ain't got a dime. Shit, I'ma hurt some fucking body, you see it in my eyes. I lie awake sometimes at night and ponder how to get ahead, jump out of bed paranoid, I'm going backwards instead. Feel like my feet is full of lead, cause I just can't move, freestyle life off the head, cause I don't know what to do. I need to make a couple moves. Ooh, I need to make a couple moves. I need to make a couple moves, but I gotta stay free, cause each and everything I do and say affects my seeds. Decide what's the truth, separated from fallacy. Separate what I want from the things that I need, and try to make a way for everything to be okay. Stay focused on my goals so you never stray away. Let the past be the past and your future's okay. Pay attention to the present, living in it every day. Come
let
on.
Let us all be checking back in with you. Like I said, it's that traffic knowledge. Let you young brothers and sisters understand that, hey, the street life, that's a dead issue, that's a dead game, that's all washed up. Let's get our life together, let's do what we need to do. Let's love more, hate none. RB, love, one. Much love to Lucinda, my manager, and my man LG. Let's do it. 100. Out.